We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnaba.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And I think someone's going to come up and introduce our speaker.
I'm Noelle, I'm an alcoholic. And I have the privilege of sponsoring Sam. I met her shortly after she came here. She comes to the early morning study group, 7:30 in the morning every day, which requires a certain level of dedication just to do that every day. But the thing that impressed me most about Sam was her willingness to go to any length. There's nothing that she wouldn't do, no hurdle she wouldn't jump, no obstacle she wouldn't attempt to overcome. She was faithful and committed from the very beginning, which made a huge difference. And it actually, working with others motivates me to work harder on my own recovery. I admire her recovery, her commitment to her family, her love of animals, and I hope you'll get to hear some of those funny stories tonight. So I'll give you Sam Marie.
Okay, not really. Came with supplies. Anybody who knows me knows I cry a lot. So I had to bring this. The clocks, I don't talk too much. I'm Sam, I'm an alcoholic. Hey. And I'm terrified. Which is probably a good thing. It's never easy. It's really interesting to be here. I will explain. I am a writer by profession and by passion, and so I wrote out my story, which I will not read to you all because we'd be here for 25 days, and that would be unfortunate. Somebody would get fired for that. Probably me. But God, for more than a decade, I've had an incredibly close relationship with wine, which is a really odd thing because I did not drink at all in high school or college or graduate school. I had watched all the ABC after school specials, you know, Marla Thomas telling you life will go to hell if you drink, and I believed them, and I didn't touch a drop. And in fact, I actually got left at my senior prom by my date because he and his sister and her date wanted to go down the shore and go get drunk and watch the sunrise come up. Yeah, I'm from New Jersey. I didn't want anything to do with that, so I actually had to call my parents to come get me from the senior prom. Did not make me the most popular person. But it made them very happy because I had just said no, and they were so proud. But in college, I hung out with this really brainy arts crowd. I don't know why I was with them. But they had alcohol at every party. And so they would make a big production of, oh, here's Sam's virgin daiquiri, and here's Sam's virgin margarita. And, of course, there were the inevitable jokes about probably the only thing virgin about me. But we don't go there. But I remember one New Year's Eve party in Virginia Highlands, and all of the guys at the party who were quite drunk thought it would be a great way to ring in the new year by climbing up on the roof of this house and peeing off the side of the roof, which they did and rang in New Year's like that. And I thought, drinking. I don't think so. Not like that. But then in my early 30s, late 90s, my career in community affairs really took off. There are a few high-profile events that were televised and got some awards and featured people like the newly elected governor telling his grand ideas for how he's going to solve transportation and sprawl problems in Atlanta. And I suddenly went from being this little desk admin to being outstanding young person of Atlanta. And I was voted into this really prestigious leadership group. I didn't understand why. I wasn't the vice president of anything. I wasn't partner in a big law firm. My family didn't come here 25,000 years ago. I wasn't rich or wealthy. I had no idea why I was there, and on the first day, I drove my little 8-year-old Geo Prism with the peeling paint on it into the parking lot. I go, okay, it's going to be great. I'm driving past the BMWs and the Mercedes and the Jags and the really expensive SUVs, and I thought, oh my God, I don't belong here. And I actually had a panic attack and I had to pull my car over and sit under a tree and calm myself and say, no, wait, there's a reason why you're in this group. Just calm yourself down. You can do this. So I grabbed my little grease-stained, no-name suitcase, dragged it up to the lodge where everybody was. I'm like, okay, I'm great. And then I walked in and met my classmates, the general manager of MARTA, the vice president of every major corporation in Atlanta, a federal assistant attorney, a TV executive, news anchor, and me. I didn't understand why I was there. I mean, I was the cheap geek who had just bought a house 2 years ago using a federally backed mortgage program for low-income first-time home buyers in the hood. And my car's paint was peeling off. So if there was ever a time to start drinking, it was now. Well, or the then of now. Because everybody there drank. And everybody was all professional and sparkly and expensive. And I had to do something to fit in. And I remember at the end of the day, they handed me a glass of wine. And I took a big sip and then 5 more sips. And I felt okay. I felt sparkly. I felt alive. I felt warm. I felt like I actually belonged there, like I could be what they thought I was. And it was wonderful. It was like somebody had injected pixie dust into my veins. And maybe I grew 5 inches taller, which didn't happen. And so from there, I started drinking. I didn't get drunk the first year or two. I didn't know anything about alcohol. A lot of my friends were wine connoisseurs, so I had them teach me about wine so I could say all the fancy names and order the fancy wines at the fancy restaurants. And every time we'd have one of our meetings, and I'd get so nervous and feel like, why am I here? All these people know more than I do. I'd have a drink, and I felt better. And oddly, on the day of graduation, turned out my 70-plus classmates had voted me the class angel for having the biggest heart with the wings to actually make good things happen. And I was so surprised, and they called my name, and I immediately grabbed my wine glass, which was half full, drank it down really fast, and then I went to stand up and almost fell over. Don't drink wine that fast on an empty stomach. And then from there, I was spun into this insane world of cocktail parties, wine and cheese, meet and greets, gala dinners with fancy long gowns and open bars and alcohol, alcohol, alcohol. And I had to learn, I thought, how to drink like them so I would fit in, so I would feel confident and grown up instead of like the little girl that I really felt like I was inside. I changed jobs and took on more responsibility. It was leadership in bold italics. And I remember this one event that I'd come up with, and we had just elected a new mayor who was about my size, and we had a crowd of about 300 people listening to her share about her new plans for her first term in office. And at the end of the night, she led everybody in singing this big round of happy birthday to me. They found out it was my birthday, and again, it was one of those moments where my mind and body didn't connect, but I felt kind of proud. And afterwards, a member of the class took me out to dinner. He was a member of the home improvement dynasties locally here in town, and I remember the 2 very big glasses of expensive wine I had because they were expensive glasses of wine, and they tasted really good, so I drank them really, really fast. And I just remember the room spinning around me, and I felt like, wow, maybe someday I could be mayor, or at least the girlfriend of a millionaire. I could do that. I became addicted to the highs of achievement, hooked on being in the know, of knowing people. I did all of these events and planned all of these things, and It was always just this weird mix between my real life when I'd go home to my tiny little poor house and being with all of these people that I thought were better than me because they were richer and they had bigger titles. And we had a big event that I organized for my job, which featured a big a fashion designer and a major cinematic legend talking to each other. And I remember feeling like I was the cool person because I got to invite who got to come to the special cocktail party beforehand and meet Bob and Ken. And I just thought, like, I own the world. And all of these people were drooling over me. I've got to meet him. And I felt like the gatekeeper and the really cool kid. And at one point, the actor turned to my friend and said, "Could you give me a beer?" I'm like, "Oh, thank God." Because then I could run to the bar, get him a beer, and drink two glasses of wine really fast. Because I felt really nervous and anxious. Which probably wasn't a good idea, because then as the event started, he turned to me and he goes, "So, Sam, what should I talk about? How do you want me to handle this?" "What do you do?" "Well, you don't throw up on his shoes." Which I didn't do, but I almost did. We chit-chatted, and it went off without a hitch, and I felt like $1 million. And then, of course, I went home and got drunk until I passed out. There are more such events and more successes, and more of them came, more pressure, but the pressure came from inside me. Because I felt if there were more people who liked me, more expensive people who knew me, more events that I went to, I would be okay. I would be an okay person, and I would deserve to be on this earth. I was coached into a complete makeover. They redid my hair, my shoes, my clothes, everything. I learned to talk differently. I got invited to all these expensive parties and the first opening of this, that, and the other. And I got hugged by people I won't mention. And I don't say any of this to brag or to show off, just to try to explain where I was and where I could have been if alcohol hadn't taken me down. Because what most magnified my feelings of insecurity and worthlessness were men. Sorry, it's not you personally, it's me. I felt so ill at ease with men that I had to have a few drinks. And then I felt like if they would be witty and sparkly and happy, I could go out on a date and be whoever they wanted me to be, whoever that was. Friends tried to set me up with ridiculous people I had no business being with. But I will say never date a radio DJ. Because if the date goes bad, it winds up on the show the next morning. It was kind of embarrassing. Yeah, don't do it. Then I started choosing my own dates, which was an interesting adventure. I dated a guy who worked the line on Anheuser-Busch and got to learn a lot about beer. I dated a guy whose brother was a winemaker out in Napa and got to learn even more about wine. That's really sped up my wine education. And then I started dating the guy that I thought was the one. Unfortunately, he was dating somebody else at the time, which I didn't care about because I was worth, you know, him breaking her heart and dumping her. Although he told me that they'd broken up and they hadn't, so she started doing drive-bys, and it was really ugly. And he eventually broke up with her and started dating me, and I thought I had won, so I went out and got drunk to celebrate. And it was a disaster from the start. I remember one time I did for some of my service work. I performed in a play called The Vagina Monologues, which, and I brought my vagina too to prove that I actually did it. See, you never travel anywhere without your sparkly pink vagina. That is my word of wisdom for you tonight. Well, the guys, I don't want to know how you get yours, but, so there was this one, my big scene in The Vagina Monologues. It was a big monologue, and we had set the stage. You could do it any way you wanted. We decided we would set it in a bar, and for the second performance, we would actually have real wine instead of the props. So I went out and got all the wine donated because I wanted to make sure it was good stuff.
not the cheap stuff. So it was at least $8 a bottle instead of $6. And then I said we should all have a glass of wine before the performance to toast our good luck and fortune. And, of course, everybody had a glass of wine, and I had 3. And so when it came time for me to go on stage, I was in the back in the dark waiting for my cue, dressed from head to toe in a burqa, because that's what my character wore. And I remember standing there in the darkness, hearing my cue and panicking because I was drunk. I couldn't remember my lines. But I had to go out anyway, and I nearly tripped and fell on my face, tripped on the hem of the burqa, and somehow, I don't know how, but when the spotlight came up, I remembered all the words. And they delivered this performance that they said made everybody cry. And I can only tell you why is because all of those words, that desperate pitched wail that rose out of me, all of that story became my story. And I remember hearing my voice bouncing off the walls, rising to the ceiling, and then crashing down like broken thunder and jagged rain, and all of that feelings of being trapped and invisible and suffering and humiliated and terrorized and humiliated, beaten, and shamed. Those were my words. And I remember speaking the last line. I had to take the burqa off my face, and the spotlight lifted, and I had to say, "You would know me." And that was the most terrifying line I ever spoke, because that is what I never wanted to happen. I didn't want anybody to know me. Because if they did, they would know that I was a damaged person. I told you. Damaged goods. A rape victim who should have died 20 years ago but didn't. Should have died in the hospital afterwards and somehow didn't. And maybe they would know that I wasn't a true community leader like they believed, but rather just a middle child from a very dysfunctional working class family from a nondescript town in the middle of the armpit of the nation. So they call New Jersey. A girl who looked like she had it all but felt like she had nothing. A girl who found refuge in her bedroom closet when her childhood, like most of yours, was pockmarked with episodes of violence. A girl terrorized as a child by a very ill older sister who then disappeared one day and remained gone for 20 years and we thought she was dead. A girl stalked and threatened in high school with her own mother siding with and aiding the stalker. Such a victim I was in my head. Good thing the cast party was at my house, although it was odd because my house was full of people I didn't know, friends of the cast, friends of the friends of the cast, friends of the director, some guy nobody knew who just showed up and drank a lot. And it must have been a good party because when I came to the next morning and went down to the kitchen to clean up, there was broken glass everywhere, which is kind of my attempt to clean up when I was in a blackout. Thinking about the dating the one guy, he didn't want to go to that performance, and he didn't understand why I did what I did. We used to fight a lot. I remember we had to go to a work conference in Toronto. He came along, and I was really resentful because I felt like he was a freeloader. Because he went on my dime. We charged everything to my office, and I was really annoyed by that, but I didn't say anything because I'm a victim. That's what I do. Let everybody beat me up. But we went, and I was really mad, and we went out to dinner. This is in Toronto, and I'd never been to Canada before. We went to dinner. I had several glasses of wine. We went to a show. I got really annoyed at something. He said, "I don't know what started the fight." Do you ever have that? I don't know what started the fight. But next thing I remember was I was knocking over to the table in the middle of the theater. And everybody turned and looked at me, which made him really mad, which made me even madder. So I ran out of the theater yelling really loudly and ran into the street and almost got hit by a taxi cab.
And at the moment, I had to say that dying by taxi cab seems pretty much like a better idea than being where I was. But then at other times, I would just melt in this pitiful puddle of maudlin self-loathing and tell him I was awful and terrible and he should leave me and I was so sorry that we had lost the baby and you should just go, but then why don't you stay and marry me and we'll live happily ever after. And all of the alcohol, he's like, are you drinking again? No, it's Fresca. It didn't smell like Fresca. It is. Leave me alone. And one night I was crying in the middle of my kitchen and he came in to see what was wrong. And all I heard was this sickening loud thud. And it wasn't until I regained consciousness so several minutes later that I realized that was my head when it hit the floor when I passed out. And what pissed me off most was he didn't support my advocacy work like my family didn't for stopping violence against women, because I'm a victim. So I had done a couple of speeches, had spoken down at the Capitol, spoken on television, done some newspaper stories. And only now do I understand how difficult it must have been to have to hear his girlfriend or my father hear his daughter share with hundreds of strangers how I was held captive for 5 hours and humiliated and repeatedly violated in the most brutal and humiliating ways. My tears and cries and begging for the assault to stop only fueled the perpetrator's enthusiasm. I love the look on your face. It's priceless. It must have been awful to have to hear about the ways I was threatened and cowed into submission and how the house had been perfectly staged for the crime with razors and jagged things carefully planted around the house just for the right moment for me. It must have been really difficult to hear me talk about scrambling around on my knees and hands trying to find my clothes in the dark while the perpetrator prepared to take me from his house for the perfect ending. Now, I managed to escape at the last minute and got to my car only seconds before he did and floored it and got out of there and managed to run every light and where the hell are the cops when you need them. And I got home and I was in such shock and pain, I didn't know where I was or who I was, and it was only an odd fluke that I happened to have a doctor's appointment the next day, but when I got there, I broke down and sobbed uncontrollably. So they locked me in a mental hospital for 18 days and drugged me so heavily I didn't know which way was up or down, and when I looked in the mirror, I had no idea who I was. My parents finally got me out of the hospital, and they finally did a medical exam, and there was plenty of signs of trauma and damage, but it was too late to gather any evidence, and now I had a record of being mentally unstable. Not a damn thing they could do in court. It must have been hard for them to listen to, because it was excruciating for me. When I was discharged from the hospital, the doctor told my parents I never again would be fully independent, that I was severely mentally ill, and the best they could hope for was that I could live in supported living and have like a half-time job. So I devoted the rest of my life to proving them wrong. I drove myself to be successful. I drove myself to do more, to be that successful girl. That girl that would get invited to all the right parties with all the right people, and all the right people would listen to me, and they would change laws, and they would make a difference, and the world would be different, because that was all I could do. And when that didn't work, I drank. Remember the last interview I did on television was in my own home, and there's a trick when you're doing interviews is to find an anchor to stare at just over the shoulder of the interviewer. And my anchor was this beautiful 750 milliliter bottle of sparkling rosé wine. It was right there. And as I told my story and the cameraman cried and the news reporter cried and the words stuck in my throat and I couldn't talk, I thought of that wine bottle and I imagined the wine coming down my throat and washing it all away, and then the words just flew right back out and banged through my teeth, and all of the story came out, and as soon as they left, it took me 15 minutes to finish that bottle of wine and another 10 for two more,
And then I floated far, far away, banging my face on the coffee table as I fell down. I continued to enjoy modest success in my work, and I actually got an award for my advocacy work called an unsung heroine. And at the award ceremony, the wine flowed freely. They had the open bar before the cocktail hour, which really was an hour. You can drink a lot of wine in an hour. And then there was the dinner with more wine, and everybody was sitting there, and I was so happy. And then it came time to give out the award, and of course I was insanely drunk by the time they called my name, and I don't know how I made it up there. I kind of walked like this up to the podium to get my award, which is a really great role model for everybody else. But what I remember is coming back to the table, and the event wasn't over, and I went to grab my wine glass to drink some more wine, and damn it, it was empty. So I was looking around at everybody else at the table, and they still had wine in their glasses. What the hell? And all I could think of was, like, how can I get the wine out of those glasses without anybody noticing? Can I reach over the table and grab that wine while they're listening to those people that are going to get mad? And I'm just like that one, and then that one, and that one, and that one, and I couldn't reach any of them. So I sat there, instead of being proud and happy for my award, I was pissed because the wine was so close and I couldn't have any of it. When I finally got home, I made up for all those lost glasses of wine. And I blacked out, and in the morning I got up, but I was so hungover and so sick I could only manage to drink about a half a glass of water before going to work. The half a glass of water, which I actually then threw up all over myself while driving to work. Never made it to work, but I did get home without wrapping myself around a tree. I used to take work trips for my job. Went to New Orleans once, I recently shared this, and I spent $600 buying everybody glass after glass of wine or whatever they wanted, lemon drop, I don't know, drop to whatever, from bar after bar after bar in New Orleans, because I felt if I didn't get everybody to drink, they'd stop drinking before I was done, and I didn't want anybody to notice how much I was drinking, so they're all drinking a whole lot. Ooh, the party would never end. Unfortunately, I ruined a couple of professional relationships on that trip, and I won't tell you why, but you can probably guess. Not proud of that. There were two other events where there's a big event with these big name speakers, and twice the paramedics had to be called because I lost track of how much wine I was drinking, and I couldn't breathe. So there is one where the CEO of, I think it was Coca-Cola, is up there talking about what a great humanitarian he is, and the paramedics come rushing in and slam me on the floor and stick oxygen on my face, and they're checking all my vitals, and I'm laying on the floor, he's trying to look there, like, look to him, no, her, him, her, what, oh, it was horrifying. So I stopped going to events. So I wouldn't have to embarrass myself in public, and I wouldn't have to stop drinking, and I wouldn't have to get a DUI, and they wouldn't call the paramedics on me. But the paramedics were called one more time, this time in Chicago. I have travel anxiety, so I drank on the plane, and then I had an Ativan to help with the anxiety, which would have been fine if after we had landed we didn't go to the bar and have some more drinks. And then go take an architectural boat tour, which doesn't feel so good after all that wine. And then we went to dinner and had more wine. And they were sitting in the lobby of the hotel drinking more, and I couldn't breathe. It's kind of hard to breathe when you've had Ativan and, like, 27 glasses of wine. So they called the paramedics. And I remember whisking through the Chicago night in the ambulance, the sirens whirring while they were checking my vital signs, trying to get me to respond, and my coworker had to go with me, and in the wee hours of the morning, they finally released me. They never checked my blood alcohol content. Nobody asked how much I drank, although I cannot imagine that they couldn't smell it. And I spent the next day in the hotel room just
Do you know how you throw up and your stomach just seizes and seizes and seizes? Well, I can't actually throw up because I had surgery in 2007 to replace the valve between my esophagus and stomach, which I had destroyed with alcohol. It stops working after a while. So I have a new valve, but it makes it impossible to throw up. So I wound up with alcohol poisoning. And it was a miracle I didn't have a seizure or a stroke or die, but nobody talked to me after that, and I was alone for the rest of the trip and came home, and they never invited me on those trips again. And at home, I started finding bruises all over my body and had to struggle to determine how I got this injury or that injury, and though I was drinking at home, not outside anymore, I was falling down all over the house, fell down the stairs, fell against the table, fell out of the chair, fell on the floor. If there was a spot in my house, I fell on it. There should be, like, body signs and blood everywhere, but there isn't. And I bruised really easily, which was the sign of my liver wasn't doing so well. I had a complicated relationship with my mother, which we won't go into. That's a whole other 12-step program. She was an addict herself. Smoked 3 packs of cigarettes every day since she was 16. She had the barrel chest of emphysema, that deep, rasping, gasping, choking, wheezing, can't-breathe cough. And she started having difficulty walking because she couldn't breathe. And sooner, she wasn't breathing anymore. She was just taking tiny sips of air. She entered the hospital on December 22nd, 2011. She had staph infections climbing up both of her legs, pneumonia in both of her lungs, masses in her lungs, and other masses in her abdomen, which they could not biopsy because she was too fragile. She only had 5% lung capacity. I spent all this time with my mom in the hospital. I took off from work, and I actually didn't drink during that time. I spent hours and hours with her, talking with her, making up, taking all the notes, trying to make up for all the lost time, because in the previous year I'd seen her only 5 times and she only lives 3 miles away from me. So I stayed home to drink. She died, holding my hand and holding my dad's hand. And in the hospital, we were standing over her dead body, matter-of-factly talking about which funeral home we would go to and which she should be cremated and what kind of box versus this and no funeral and we'll have a party instead. And my dad turned to me and he said, "Hon, I want you to promise me one thing. When you go home, don't drink." And it was the first and only time anybody in my family said anything about alcohol. Of course, I went home and got drunk. What else was I going to do? But that was the beginning of my realization that that was going to be me in a couple of months if I didn't stop and do something. My dad's anguish tormented me, and I hurt so badly I couldn't breathe, but alcohol couldn't help anymore, except I was in a blackout for about almost every day and was drunkenly incoherent on a couple of work calls, including with the company employee assistance counselor. Don't do that. Or do that, because she called me the next day and she says, "I think you have an alcohol problem." I said, "Well, how would make you think that? You were drunk and passed out during our phone call." "Oh. I thought maybe in my mom's death I could find a way to live again, so I entered rehab on March 17th, 2012. I poured every ounce of alcohol down the drain, and I didn't have a drop. They got mad at me at rehab, saying, "You could have died quitting cold turkey. I was drinking 3 bottles of wine a day, sometimes 4, every day. There's not a lot of room for that in here, although it was a little bigger when I came in." They told me I had to go home and rid my house of everything related to alcohol. And I said, "I poured out all the alcohol. What's left in the house?" They're like, "Anything related to alcohol, whatever you drank out of, whatever you drank with, whatever you held your bottles in and with." And I'm like, "But
But the glasses are expensive. They were beautiful, handmade, hand-blown works of art. I can't get rid of them. And this guy goes, this is a handmade work of art, Bong. I can't get rid of it. Like, oh, I see your point. And then he told me I had to go to AA. I was like, ugh. But I went to rehab. I don't have to go to AA. I went to rehab. That's why I went to rehab, so I wouldn't have to go to AA. Like, it doesn't work that way. Now you tell me. I went $10,000 into this, and I still got to go to AA. Dang it. So I went home and I got rid of them. I took everything out of all of the cabinets, all the mismatched wine glasses, because I broke most of them, so nothing matched. The 200 plus corks I had saved I have no idea why. I had lovingly saved them like a shrine. These are my corks. My pint glasses that I collected during my travels. The dessert wine glasses. So, because why eat dessert when you can drink it? Right? The glass, special glasses I used for this drink or that drink, the coasters and the kitchen towels with the beautiful scenes of wine country, the bottle stoppers I never used because if the bottle's open, why put a cork in it? Drink it! See, and I had all these leftover wine bottles that I used as vases and I had turned some into lamps for the bar. And then I remembered, oh yeah, there's those funky bar signs out in the backyard, which reminded me of all the beer logo t-shirts I had upstairs. And once I went up and got those, I remembered, oh yeah, there's that Merlot flavored lip balm over in the bathroom. And the champagne flavored soap. Oh, it's supposed to be scented soap. I have no idea. And then, of course, I had to go back down into the kitchen and get the champagne-flavored jelly, the Cabernet steak sauce, the whiskey barbecue sauce, and the pot roast soaking, and I have no idea which wine. And then, oh, yeah, there were those ice wine candies. Maybe I was an alcoholic. But when it came time to getting those little tumblers, I just couldn't throw them away. No, not those. And then I looked at them and they made me want to drink so badly. I shoved them in the cabinet, closed the door, went to bed, cried myself to sleep. And then the next morning I got up and came to AA here. My first AA meeting. It was the Saturday newcomers meeting. I thought I was in a circus. And I belonged. They asked, is there any newcomers? And they go, I'm Sam and I'm a alcoholic. All right, Sam, we're so glad you're here. And everybody was so happy and cheerful and I was so miserable. I'm like, what the hell is wrong with you people? You're not drinking. But you were all talking about I used to get chased by the cops. I used to knock over mailboxes. I beat up the mailman. And now I'm sober. And you were laughing about all of this. And I was miserable thinking, I'm never going to drink again. And you're laughing about how great life was never drinking again. At least for that day. I was like, wow, you might be onto something. So I talked with somebody after the meeting. And she's like, I want to ask you one thing. Because you'd mentioned about those glasses. Which is worth living for? Would you rather live? Would you rather die for the glasses? I was like, oh. Because if you want to stop drinking, you have to have no reservations. And I thought, my blood pressure was too high, my liver was damaged. It hurt all the time, and I had a ridiculous amount of bile coursing through my body, which is very painful. I had surgery to repair my GI tract and thousands of dollars of dental work to repair the teeth that I had damaged with all of that alcohol. I was going to have more surgery for the arm I had banged up by falling on it repeatedly. I was ill with one infection after another, requiring longer and longer courses of antibiotics as my immune system weakened. My hands actually shook all the time, and my head had this odd tremor that never seemed to stop. And at one point, I thought, maybe I have Parkinson's disease. And I had hoped I did, because that would have been better than being an alcoholic. Until I got sober. And I looked again at those glasses, and I thought about the wine, and I thought,
I didn't almost die and live to die like this. I remember getting down on my knees in my house and crying and praying, God, help me. Show me the way. I'm clearly powerless over alcohol. And I did get rid of everything. We sold it at a garage sale, which was kind of neat. And I threw myself into AA. I attended the early morning study group at 7:30 every morning, 7 days a week. And it is our hope that you will come back and get to know us. You gotta sing. Come on.
I hope you know all about you.
Thank you. I came to the meeting every day, and often the 5:45, and sometimes the 1:30 if I needed an extra dose. I got a sponsor and began working the steps. Sundays had been my worst drinking day, so I met with my sponsor on Sundays. Because instead of it being the worst day of my life, it would then become the most healing day of my life. I was on medical leave while I attended rehab for 3 months, and at the end of that time, they told us, you can come back or we really don't want you. And none of your coworkers want to ever see you again. Ever. Don't talk to them. But we'll take you back because we're legally obligated to, and I came in here, and y'all know, I whined and complained, it's so unfair, I can't believe it, I was such a good worker. I didn't do anything wrong, I don't understand. And you heard the story, I would have fired me too. And a lot sooner than they did. And they were better off without me. No one wanted to be around the darkness I had become. My work had become all I lived for, and then alcohol became all I lived for. And it didn't matter, because no matter how successful I was, how much I drank, how much people loved me, or how much I tried to destroy myself, it wouldn't have made a difference, because I drank to ease the pain and fill the emptiness and drown the voices inside my head telling me I was a failure, damaged goods, no good, no one would want me, no one deserved me. I was a victim and I deserved everything that happened to me because it was my fault. But clearing my house of all the stuff associated with alcohol really jump-started my recovery because it showed me what I had to do with working the steps. It took me months to get through step 4. Oh my God. You gotta do the fear inventory, the sex inventory, the fear of the sex inventory, the resentment inventory, can I just go and do the clothing inventory over at Target? It would be a lot better. But because of that, I discovered all the ways that I had compromised my principles, sold my morals, betrayed my body, denied my own heart, did immoral and wrongful things in a misguided attempt to feel better about myself. I gave up on my dreams, myself, and worse, my God. And I very nearly died from it. And at the heart of it all was this gaping hole torn inside me by that one night. When my identity was stolen, it felt like. My body was stolen and brutalized, and my spirit was shattered. And then I victimized myself again and again and again. I was a bigger perpetrator then. I had severe workaholism. I didn't stand up for myself. I didn't stand for anything. I had no real connection between my body and my mind. They were two separate entities, and the further apart they stayed, the better. I tried to drink that away, and when it didn't work, and I discovered all of that through steps 4 and 5, and it did more for me than more than a decade of therapy with therapists had ever done. Of course, in fairness, I drank through most of that, so I don't know how successful it would have been. But the step work was amazing. How I uncovered what I was doing to myself and why I was doing it, and that I was my own victim. And in here, you didn't let me be a victim. You held me accountable. My sponsor held me accountable very gently and very beautifully. She wasn't harsh. She was loving and kind, and so were most of you. And I discovered at the heart how I was so full of self-centered fear and pride, and I thought, I have no pride, I hate myself. But I was so proud of being a victim. But not anymore. I mean, I get laughed for that from my animal stories and my Jewish experience of God and dewdrops and my cats doing great things and rescuing chipmunks before they eat them. And that's okay, because for me, being connected to nature and to animals heals me. Being able to see that gentleness reminds me there is so much more in this world than just me. And so much more of this world that needs me to protect it, respect it, love it, and just admire it, and just be with it, to stop fighting myself or anything else. I lost that job that brought me so much success. And one of the reasons why I focused so much on telling my story on the work things was because I was in such denial about that, about what I had done and who I was and what I deserved to have happen and not have happen. And so thank you to all of you who listened to me from, I can't believe I just said that, all of you? Still so New Jersey. That is awesome. And it's funny, I felt so humiliated and so ashamed. Like, I lost all of that stature, all of those people, all of those wonderful titles and accolades. But I have to tell you that in here, I feel more real, more like a champion, more like I matter than I ever did in my life before. And I wouldn't trade any of it for this moment, for this sobriety, for this kind of, not high, but of just being. In January, I got a new job, which I thought would be perfect because I could hide out in a little desk job. And then God decided, you know what, I want to teach you a lesson. And so he made me absolutely miserable in that job. And y'all had to listen to me whine about that for months. Like, oh my God, it's horrible. Nobody talks to anybody. They just email each other and they're 10 feet away. Good Lord. So I started my own company. It's just shocking. And now I actually, within a month, I have all these clients. And you know what I was doing today? I was helping interview high school students for a leadership program. High school students who come from low-income neighborhoods, like, well, where I live. Kids who, this is the most extraordinary thing. I was interviewing this one girl, and she said, one of the questions you asked, what is the biggest obstacle you've had to overcome? She said, well, I'm 16, and I've never known my father. I know I have a father, but I don't know where he is. I've never talked to him. I've never spoken to him. She said, so it's been tough to try to know my identity and know where I fit in. She said, but he called me today. For the first time in her entire life, on the day for her interview when I had the privilege of interviewing her. That's what being sober is about, to see God at work performing miracles. I mean, in somebody else's life, and to be there to witness that moment. I never would have done that. God gave me this. God gave me this moment and gave me every one of you. I have a year and a half of sobriety now. I chair meetings sometimes. I bring in treats. I'm gluten-free, so it doesn't always go over well. Still learning how that works. So thank you for all pretending it's good while spitting it out in the trash can. I've seen that. And I have friends, and we gather here for Saturday breakfast, and we talk about nothing important except song lyrics and pop culture and salty bananas and just stupid stuff, and it's wonderful. Because I'm sober on a Saturday morning, and I'm not wishing to, I was dying. And perhaps the greatest gift I've received, something I never expected, was forgiveness. I've been doing my amends with step 9. I apologize to my ex for being a lousy girlfriend. And we're friends. I apologize to my family, to my sister, for screaming at her in the middle of a New Year's Eve party in a drunken rage in front of her children, telling her she was a horrible mother and going to hell, and her children are looking at me going, "What happened to Aunt?" And when I told my niece and nephew, my niece said, "That's okay, Aunt. We were just kids then. We didn't understand, but we're teenagers now. And you're sober for us now, and we need you now." My nephew went to Greece this summer for a leadership program. He just finished 8th grade. He brought me back this necklace from Greece. That's forgiveness. He said, "It is beautiful like you, Aunt." I'm fully accountable and present. I show up when I say I will. I do what I'm supposed to do. I take my niece and nephews to tutoring, to band practice, to all these cool things that I get to be a part of, for haircuts, doctor's appointments, and they trust me because that I'm going to actually show up on time and not embarrass them. But there's another forgiveness that I didn't expect and that I found. Forgiving my mother for not being the perfect mother that I thought I should have, for being an addict and for dying for her own addiction. And where I was so filled with resentment and anger and self-pity and for months whined about that, I had a word, oh, good Lord. I feel nothing but love and gratitude. And the greatest one is I forgave the perpetrator. I never thought that I would do that. But there's no sense carrying that around. I'm still working on forgiving myself. But I am working on it. Because I remember that I didn't die for a reason. Not that night, not any of the other nights that I drank myself almost into a coma, that I drove drunk and miraculously didn't hit a tree or someone else. I didn't die the times I went under surgery to fix the things that alcohol had damaged. God gave me life again and again and again, and who am I to refuse it? And who am I to live it? I'm a humble child of God, a survivor, a daughter, a sister, an aunt, a friend, and maybe even someday I'll be a sponsor. I'm a servant of God, gratefully living a right-sized life, and I'm trying to live out God's dreams, not mine. And who am I to live it? I'm Sam Marie Engel, and I'm an alcoholic and a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. That was awesome.